Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. The Missouri Radio Free Kansas.
I don't believe that people who are the L, the G, the B, or the T should be persecuted, assaulted, imprisoned, even killed for who they are. Too many people believe they have a direct line to the divine, and they never want to change their mind about anything. They're never open to new information, and they like to operate in an evidence-free zone. You could not be having the sweep of marriage equality across our country if nobody changed their mind, and thank goodness so many of us have.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Luxembourg jumps the broom, thousands promote pink families in Hong Kong, and Hillary engages in a heated marriage equality debate. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Natalie Peoples.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending June 21st, 2014. Lawmakers in the tiny European nation of Luxembourg approved a bill on June 18th to extend civil marriage and adoption rights to same-gender couples. And it wasn't even close. The vote was 56-4. The outcome was expected, though perhaps not so resoundingly, in a country that's already elected openly gay Xavier Bettel as its prime minister. As it happens, his deputy prime minister, Etienne Schneider, is also an out gay man. The country's Roman Catholic Church may have eased the process by staying publicly silent on the draft legislation, perhaps because a public opinion poll conducted last year found 83% of the population in support of marriage equality. The Associated Press called the legislation the most fundamental rewrite of Luxembourg's laws on marriage since 1804. According to the official government website for the Chamber of Deputies, the new statutes could take effect in early 2015, or 6 months after their official publication. Luxembourg becomes the 17th country in the world to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. It joins Argentina, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, Denmark, England and Wales, France, Iceland, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Portugal, South Africa, Spain, Sweden, and Uruguay. Same-gender civil marriages are expected to begin in Scotland later this year. Gay and lesbian couples can also legally marry in some parts of the United States and Mexico.
In heavily Roman Catholic Italy, Prime Minister Matteo Renzi announced government legislation this week to create civil unions for the country's same-gender couples and to recognize the civil marriages of same-gender couples legally performed elsewhere. Efforts to pass civil unions legislation over the past 2 decades in the Italian Parliament have failed. But the Prime Minister and his center-left Democrats included a call for LGBT equality in their party platform. And Renzi told La Repubblica that the rights for same-gender couples in civil unions will be the same as those for married heterosexual couples. The latest polls indicate majority support in Italy for civil unions. Ivan Scalfarotto, the Democratic Party's openly gay vice president, told reporters that, "In a perfect world, I would like to have marriage equality in Italy, but I would rather have civil unions immediately." The Italian Senate is expected to begin debate on the legislation in September. The Vatican announced in April that Catholic bishops would be holding what it called an extraordinary meeting later this year to discuss the growing acceptance of same-gender unions around the world, though no one expects a significant change in church policy to result.
The General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA approved a proposal this week by a 71% majority to change the definition of marriage in the Christian denomination's Book of Order from the union of a man and a woman to two people. The overwhelming margin of victory came as a bit of a surprise to many who've seen similar proposals narrowly defeated in previous years. Holding its biennial meeting in Detroit, the Assembly also passed a measure allowing Presbyterian clergy to immediately begin performing wedding ceremonies for gay and lesbian couples in the 19 U.S. states and the District of Columbia that have legalized it. A majority of the 172 regional presbyteries must still vote to ratify the new language, but given the lopsided 3-to-1 vote in the Assembly, the Religion News Service predicts easy approval. The 1.8 million member Presbyterian Church USA has been ordaining openly gay and lesbian ministers, including those who are partnered, since 2011.
In other news, the Hong Kong government has asked the British consulate not to host the civil marriages of same-gender couples. The British Foreign and Commonwealth Office announced last week that overseas missions could perform weddings for Britons and their partners, even in countries where it's illegal under local laws, unless the hosting jurisdiction objects. The 23 countries with British consulates around the world named last week to host the marriages of British same-gender couples include Russia and mainland China. Neither of those countries has opposed the move. Hong Kong activists criticized both their local officials and the British government. Nigel Collette of the LGBT rights group Pink Alliance told the media that the British Foreign Office is allowing conservative and homophobic elements in the bureaucracy of this city to dictate what is done on the soil of a British consulate. But there were reports later in the week that the British consulate is reconsidering its compliance with Hong Kong's request after someone pointed out that the Spanish consulate in Hong Kong has been marrying same-gender couples for quite some time.
And more than 11,000 people demonstrated for equality at Hong Kong's Tamar Park on June 15th. Organizers called the event "We Are Family, the Freedom to Love." Mirroring a similar expression of support for LGBT rights in Singapore, the first ever family-themed Pink Dot Hong Kong featured picnics, an outdoor concert, and special guest appearances. Attendees wore pink T-shirts and gathered together to form an impressive pink dot as seen from above to symbolize solidarity and inclusiveness. Brian Leung of the Big Love Alliance, which along with the Pink Alliance sponsored the event, said that, "We are more than thrilled by the turnout and the atmosphere of the inaugural Pink Dot."
The notoriously anti-equality U.S. National Organization for Marriage must be sorely disappointed, however. Even though they bust people in from outside the district for the much-ballyhooed event, a paltry 2,000 die-hard opponents of marriage equality rallied against it on the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol on June 19th. The usual suspects joined Noam President Brian Brown to speak at the rally. They included failed Republican presidential wannabes Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, San Francisco Roman Catholic Archbishop Salvatore Cordelone, outspokenly anti-LGBT Bishop Harry Jackson of Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland, and New York State Senator Ruben Diaz. Ludovine de Rocher, who led efforts to oppose France's civil marriage equality law that took effect last year, exhorted the crowd to never surrender. Of the underwhelming crowd, veteran gay journalist Rex Walkner tweeted, "There are that many people wandering around the mall at random on any pleasant day. Hashtag maximum fail."
Updating a previous report, the Canadian government has now granted visas to a group of Ugandan LGBT activists so they can attend the World Pride 2014 Human Rights Conference in Toronto in the coming week. Immigration officials reportedly refused to approve the applications when they were originally submitted out of fear that all of the Ugandans would seek political asylum. Equality activists praised the change of heart. Brenda Kossman, director of the University of Toronto's Bonham Center for Sexual Diversity Studies, told the local Star newspaper that the conference is an important part of World Pride, and the Ugandan voices are an integral part to that dialogue. Award-winning Ugandan activist Frank Mugisha, who had already been granted a visa, was scheduled to deliver the keynote address.
Elsewhere, the Obama administration has been trying to bring U.S. law into compliance with last year's Supreme Court ruling allowing the federal government to recognize the legal marriages of same-gender couples. The White House announced just this week that the Department of Labor is beginning the process of extending the benefits detailed in the Family and Medical Leave Act to all married same-gender couples nationwide, even in states that don't recognize those marriages. Other benefits that have already been specifically extended include the ability to file joint federal tax returns, claim insurance and retirement benefits for spouses of federal employees, and spousal benefits for members of the military. But according to a report issued this week by Attorney General Eric Holder, actions by federal agencies and presidential executive orders have gone about as far as they can go. Federal law allows the Social Security Administration and the Department of Veterans Affairs to offer benefits only to same-gender couples living in states that recognize their marriage. As the advocate noted, for example, if a couple lives in a state that does not recognize their marriage and one spouse dies, the other spouse does not have access to federal Social Security survivor's benefits.
Those critical laws can't be changed without congressional action. Several pending bills identified by the Human Rights Campaign include the Respect for Marriage Act, the Veteran Spouses Equal Treatment Act, the Military Spouses Equal Treatment Act, Protecting the Freedoms and Benefits for All Veterans Act, and the Social Security and Marriage Equality Act. In a media release, Evan Wolfson of Freedom to Marry praised the Obama administration, noting that the federal government had gone from being the number one discriminator against gay people to now putting its moral and legal weight on the side of our families, the Constitution, and the freedom to marry. But it's time for Congress, and especially the Supreme Court, to finish the job.
And finally, it wasn't all that long ago that conventional wisdom equated support for LGBT rights with political suicide. But his support for marriage equality didn't seem to hamper the re-election this week of Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos. The 62-year-old Santos, first elected in 2010, defeated former Finance Minister Oscar Iván Zuluaga by a 6-point margin. But Santos has his work cut out for him. A marriage equality bill was overwhelmingly defeated in Colombia's Senate last year. The national LGBT rights group Colombia Diversa applauded Santos's re-election victory, however, noting that rainbow flags were displayed inside the incumbent's campaign headquarters.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 21st, 2014. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Natalie Peoples.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Hillary gets pilloried on marriage equality later in the program. Who could forget last week's Texas Republican Party platform regression into a revival of so-called reparative therapy? The Daily Show with Jon Stewart offered the Lone Star GOP a typically caustic Comedy Central cure, with some diagnostic assistance from CNN's Anderson Cooper.
At its annual convention over the weekend, the Texas Republican Party endorsed a controversial therapy that purports to fix gay people. It's known as reparative or gay conversion therapy.
What? What? Texas, what? The state that can't even go a week without an oil pipeline spewing thinks it's the gays that need repairing? Now, while the rest of the country inches forward on gay rights, Texas apparently hopping into Doc Brown's DeLorean and setting the dial of the 1950s. It's the subject of tonight's Gay Watch, Texas edition, Remember the No Homo. Reparative therapy's been derided as praying the gay away. Perhaps we should mention that some of the techniques reparative therapists use involve threatening to hook their genitals up to electrodes or ordering someone to bottle their feces and sniff it whenever they are attracted to a man. Given that all reputable psychologists and doctors have repudiated reparative therapy, and that the largest reparative therapy purveyor even apologized for the damage they caused, why would Texas teach the controversy, so to speak?
The language is in the platform because we want to make sure that people have rights.
Texas lawmaker Brian Hughes.
This is about giving people choices.
Oh. This is about Texas GOP being pro-choice. They want to preserve choice for their citizens. Choice in their lives, in their health care options. Well, some of their health care options.
More than 6 million people in this state do not have health insurance. It's about 24% of the total population.
We're not going to participate in exchanges.
Texas Governor Rick Perry.
We're not going to expand Medicaid.
So, gay reparative therapy, yes! Human body reparative therapy. If you're one of the 6 million Texans without health insurance, maybe it's time to tell them you think your arthritis
is making you gay. What's that, son? What's that, son? What? You feel like when it's about to rain, you want to suck. Well, put away your wallet. You don't need to co-pay the gay away. Come on in.
That was a dose of Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Hello, I'm Bruce Valanche. When I'm not lounging at Sky Bar with Bet or Whoopi, I'm listening to This Way Out. Please do stay tuned.
Hillary Rodham Clinton may not be officially running for president, but the former U.S. First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State's current book tour has her running into more hard choices than its title might suggest. One of her more extensive interviews involving LGBT rights was featured on NPR's Fresh Air. It was smooth sailing for Clinton's conversation with host Terry Gross through the deep waters of transsexuality, but they hit rough seas when it came to Clinton's position on marriage equality.
I want to move on to LGBT rights, which was very important to you as Secretary of State. You made it one of your priorities. In fact, you gave a speech at the headquarters of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva with the goal to place LGBT rights in the international community's framework of human rights. In that speech, you said, like being a woman, like being a racial, religious, tribal, or ethnic minority, being LGBT does not make you less human. And that is why gay rights are human rights, and human rights are gay rights. I found it very interesting that you decided to not limit what you were saying to gay rights, but to include transgender people.
Well, LGBT includes the T, and I wanted to stand up for the entire community. I don't believe that people who are the L, the G, the B, or the T should be persecuted, assaulted, imprisoned, even killed, for who they are. And this was the debate that I was having with leaders in many parts of the world who first denied there were any such people in their communities, that it was all an invention and export of the West, and then would change the argument to they didn't want people being proselytized, they didn't want children being abused. And I said, well, there are laws against that that are certainly appropriate. No one should be coerced. No one should be abused. But you're talking about the status, the very core of who a person is. And it has become, and I think will continue to be, a very important issue for the United States to combat around the world and to stand up for the rights of all people. And as I said, not just women, religious, ethnic, tribal, all people, including the LGBT community.
You added gender identity to the State Department's Equal Employment Opportunity Policy, and you made it easier for Americans to change their sex on their passport. Did you have to sneak that in without a lot of attention? I didn't know you'd done that, but I have a feeling if a lot of people had known you'd done that, you would have gotten a lot of pushback for that, because there's still a lot of people in our country who oppose gay rights and would probably even more so oppose, like, any recognition of the transgender community. So did you do that on the quiet?
Well, I don't know how quiet it was. Even before I did that, I spoke to the LGBT employees at the State Department. I was aware of their hopes for some changes that might make it easier for them to be the professionals that they had signed up to be. I don't think it was any big secret. I think it was part of the overall effort to try to treat people with dignity and equality. And certainly the Obama administration made some of its own moves at the same time with respect to the larger federal employee pool. And when I had responsibility for the well-being of the 70,000 or so employees around the world who worked for the State Department and USAID, I had an opportunity through executive action to recognize that there were barriers and vestiges of discrimination that had no place in a modern American workplace, and so I acted.
So what's it like when you're in office and you have to do all these political calculations to not be able to support something like gay marriage that you actually believe in? And you obviously feel very committed to human rights, and you obviously put gay rights as part of human rights, but in doing the calculus, you decided you couldn't support it. Correct me if I'm reading it wrong.
Well, I think you're reading it very wrong. I think that, as I said, just as the president has said, you know, just because you're a politician doesn't mean you're not a thinking human being. And you gather information, you think through positions, you're not 100% set, thank goodness. You're constantly reevaluating where you stand. So for me, marriage had always been a matter left to the states. And in many of the conversations that I and my colleagues and supporters had, I fully endorsed the efforts by activists to work state by state. And in fact, that is what is working. And I think that, you know, being in the position that I was in the Senate, fighting employment discrimination, which we still have some ways to go, was appropriate at that time. As Secretary of State, I was out of domestic politics, and I was certainly doing all I could on the international scene to raise the importance of the human rights of the LGBT community. And then leaving that position, I was able to, you know, very quickly announce that I was fully in support of gay marriage and that it is now continuing to proceed state by state. And I am very, very hopeful that we will make progress and see even, you know, more change in acceptance. One of my big problems right now is that too many people believe they have a direct line to the divine and they never want to change their mind about anything. They're never open to new information and they like to operate in an evidence-free zone. And I think it's good if people continue to change.
So you mentioned that you believe in state by state for gay marriage, but it's the Supreme Court, too. The Supreme Court struck down part of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which prevented the federal government from recognizing gay marriage. That part is now struck down. And DOMA was actually signed by your husband when he was president. In spite of the fact that he signed it, were you glad at this point that the Supreme Court struck some of it down?
Of course. And you know, again, let's... We are living at a time when this extraordinary change is occurring, and I'm proud of our country. I'm proud of the people who have been on the front lines of advocacy. But in 1993, that was not the case, and there was a very concerted effort in the Congress to, you know, make it even more difficult and greater discrimination. And what DOMA did is at least allow the states to act. It wasn't going yet to be recognized by the federal government, but at the state level, there was the opportunity. And my husband, you know, was the first to say that, you know, the political circumstances, the threats that were trying to be alleviated by the passage of DOMA, thankfully, were no longer so preeminent, and we could keep moving forward, and that's what we're doing.
So just to clarify, just one more question on this. Would you say your view evolved since the 90s or that the American public evolved allowing you to state your real view?
I think I'm an American. I think we have all evolved. And it's been one of the fastest, most sweeping transformations.
No, I understand,
I'm
but a lot
aware.
Of people already believed in it back in the 90s. A lot of
but
people
not,
already supported
it. Not that, but yeah. to be fair, Terry, not that many. Yes, were there activists who were ahead of their time? Well, that was true in every human rights and civil rights movement. But the vast majority of Americans were just waking up to this issue and beginning to, you know, think about it and grasp it for the first time and, you know, think about their neighbor down the street who deserved to have the same rights as they did or their son or their daughter. It
It has been an extraordinarily fast, by historic terms, social, political, and legal transformation, and we ought to celebrate that instead of plowing old ground where, in fact, a lot of people, the vast majority of people, have been moving forward, maybe slowly, maybe tentatively, maybe not as quickly and extensively as many would have hoped, but nevertheless, we are at a point now where equality, including marriage equality, in our country is solidly established, although there will be places, Texas, just to name one, where that is still going to be an ongoing struggle.
I'm pretty sure you didn't answer my question about whether you evolved or it was the American public that changed with you.
I said I'm an American, so of course we all evolved, and I think that that's a fair,
opinion,
a fair conclusion.
So you're saying your opinion on gay marriage changed, as opposed to you just felt it was comfortable.
Somebody is always first, Terry. Somebody's always out front, and thank goodness they are. But that doesn't mean that those who join later in being publicly supportive or even privately accepting that there needs to be change are any less committed. You could not be having the sweep of marriage equality across our country if nobody changed their mind, and thank goodness so many of us have.
So that's one for you changed your mind.
I have to say, I think you are being very persistent, but you are playing with my words and playing with what is such an
important
issue.
I'm just trying to clarify so I can understand.
No, I don't think you are trying to clarify. I think you're trying to say that, I used to be opposed and now I'm in favor and I did it for political reasons, and that's just flat wrong. So let me just state what I feel like you are implying and repudiate it. I have a strong record. I have a great commitment to this issue, and I am proud of what I've done and the progress we're making.
Yeah, I'm saying, I'm sorry, I just want to clarify what I was saying. No, I was saying that you maybe really believed this all along, but, believed in gay marriage all along, but felt for political reasons America wasn't ready yet and you couldn't say it. That's what I was thinking.
No, that is not true.
Okay.
I did not grow up even imagining gay marriage, and I don't think you probably did either. This was an incredibly new and important idea that people on the front lines of the gay rights movement began to talk about, and slowly but surely convinced others of the rightness of that position. And when I was ready to say what I said it.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that.
Hillary Rodham Clinton's interview with Fresh Air's Terry Gross created such an uproar that Clinton was called upon to continue clarifying in subsequent appearances. She told CNN's Christiane Amanpour that she had indeed evolved over time and was proud to be a full supporter of marriage equality right now. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Christopher Gall and Natalie Peoples contributed program material. Thanks also to Steve Pride. Robert Palmer performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, and our generous listeners for making this program possible. Log on to thiswayout.org to check out our brand new Stitcher Radio on-demand player and download the free mobile app. You'll also find our social media links and much more. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WMNF Tampa, Florida, KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 3UGE Alexander, Victoria, and more than 200 other radio stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You can write a book on what's going on. Everyone you know's got to reap what they sow, be it right or wrong. day heard you say that there's nothing you can do. I wonder if you feel the same if it was happening to you. Don't forget that pride always goes to come fall.
Cat Edmonds. Cat Edmondson. Oh, Ed, what a great voice. I mean, I really like her. Hey, are you having a good day yet today? Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, lunchtime edition. We'll be keeping, you know, I think we're going to be shifting almost all of our shows to noon to 2, 7 days a week now. I think it's better. I'm negotiating with TuneIn Radio, and we're going to go into further syndication, hopefully soon, and we'll be reaching out to even more listeners across cyberspace. If you know any friends in Kansas, tell them to listen to Radio Free Kansas. I appreciate it. They can always get the archived at the Fightin' Cock Flyer blogspot. The irreverent, infamous Fightin' Cock Flyer blogspot. I am so happy to bring this show to you. A couple more from Cat Edmonds. From down in Austin, Texas, a wonderful, large blue dot in that red state, Austin, Texas. More coming up with Amanda Marcotte's reality podcast. And last night I received from Naomi Fowler for June, tackling tax havens across the pond. Thank you, Naomi Fowler, for providing it to us in Kansas. Here's The Cure cover and one more, Summertime by Cat Edmonds.
One that makes me scream, she said. One that makes me laugh, she said. And threw her arms around my neck and show me how you do it. And I promise that I'll run away with you. I'll run away. Oh, why are you so far away? strange as angels dancing in the deepest ocean, twisting in water, you're just like a dream. You're just like a dream.
Thank you.
in the sky, you know how I feel. We drifting by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life, and I'm feeling good.
Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinions, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be talking to Sarah Merck about the history of sex education films, followed up by some of the more entertaining clips I found from them. Also, there's a good chance Hillary Clinton is going to run for president, which means that sexist attacks on female politicians are starting to be a real problem again. It's a problem we need to stop for the good of everyone. Recently on Comedy Bang Bang, Scott Aukerman, Reggie Watts, and Lizzie Kaplan debated the hot topic of whether men could be funny.
I've never found a boy funny.
Well, I think boys can be funny, okay? I just think maybe they haven't had the opportunity to be funny for as long as girls have.
They were always raised to be like, oh, you look so handsome. It's like they never need to be funny.
Exactly.
I just think it's biological. Guys are not funny. It's just because they're just not.
Their huge penises get in the way, I think.
Yeah, they do get in the way.
It's like, ugh, I can't. Come on, I'm trying to see if this guy's funny.
I'm so distracted by your penis in your pants that I can't focus on all the jokes you're trying to tell.
Clearly, we need someone to make a list of all the funny men so we can present it to a group of women so they can go down the list, striking anyone they claim is not funny and making excuses for why the rest don't count somehow. Y'all, Hillary Clinton hasn't even declared that she's running for president in 2016, and already things are getting completely out of control when it comes to the issue of her gender. In an ideal world, the fact that Clinton is a woman shouldn't really be an issue. Indeed, in the ideal world, people would look at her record, both pros and cons, and determine how they're going to vote based on the issues and on their sense of how well she would perform as a leader. At bare minimum, it would be nice if people acknowledged that we have never had a female president before and that the majority of elected leaders in the United States are male, and that demonstrates that being a woman actually tends to work against you as a politician. But instead, we're being subjected to right-wing fantasy land rants where pundits pretend that being a woman is somehow a benefit to Clinton. After claiming that Clinton can't run on her record or promise to continue Obama policies, Rush Limbaugh hit the claim that drawing attention to her gender would help her.
So she's got to run on history. First female. My turn, and it's bring Bill Clinton back to Washington. They think that will be a winner. And you combine that with whatever they're going to say about whoever the Republican nominee is. And if it's Christie, sets them up even better.
But is this true? Nope. In reality, as research by the organization Name It, Change It has shown, drawing attention to a female candidate's gender tends to hurt her chances. It's worse if people say sexist stuff about her, which Clinton tends to get a lot, but the effect holds even if the attention a candidate gets is seemingly positive. This is a bipartisan problem and not just something that affects Democrats or Republicans, which means that regardless of your party affiliation, you should have an interest in defeating these ridiculous attempts to reduce Clinton to her gender. It hurts all women, regardless of party, if women are forever being made to feel like they have to answer for their gender somehow. And yes, Clinton continues to be subject to attacks that start from the assumption that her gender somehow gives her an unfair advantage or that her gender somehow disqualifies her, such as with Reality Cast favorite Keith Ablow of Fox News on the show Outnumbered. The female hosts of the show are all Republicans and were attacking Clinton on foreign policy, but they never suggested anything about her gender should be held against her. But not Ablow.
Now, here's the question I have. It may be impolitic, but what qualifications, this was not a distinguished Senate, life that she had particularly. She didn't particularly distinguish herself as Secretary of State. So other than being the wife of the president, Why is she running? In other words, are we so heck-bent on getting a woman elected president that we're going to fall all over ourselves to do it despite an undistinguished record?
Well, and that's the...
His implication couldn't be clearer, that there is no such thing as a woman that could be qualified to be president, and therefore we have to shoehorn someone in who has no real qualifications. It's almost laughably transparent what he's doing here, because whether or not you like Clinton or agree with her, she does, in fact, have a hefty career as a lawyer, a policymaker, a senator, and a cabinet member. By making this about her husband, ABLO is trying to make this all about her gender and try to reduce her to saying she's just someone's wife, even though she's held higher offices than her husband did before he was president. And he clearly, from that statement, finds it implausible that a woman could ever be distinguished enough. Again, regardless of your party, this kind of sexism should offend you because it can and will be used to discredit any woman who runs. In fact, it's not just right-wing pundits anymore who are trying to imply that being a woman gives you an unfair advantage, even though the actual statistics tell a much different story. In a segment about Clinton, CNN's Chris Cuomo got all whiny at the supposed disadvantages that male candidates face when up against female candidates, particularly when women's issues are at stake.
I'll tell you, it's just hard to deal with as a male candidate. You know, if whatever Hillary or any female candidate wants to put forward as a female agenda, right? Not even feminist agenda, just female agenda.
Yeah.
What is the guy supposed to say? Oh, I'm going to take issue with that. Oh, I want to be that also. You know, I just
he
think
can't.
It's just smart politics.
Yeah.
And you can very much argue it's come to be that.
There's not evidence that anyone is pushing a quote-unquote female agenda. There are plenty of female politicians that support policies that are anti-woman, and plenty of male politicians that support policies that are pro-woman. There is no reason to think that the voters are confused about this. And that's why it's so troubling to see how female politicians, regardless of party, get reduced to their gender. Or the way that it's implied that only women have a gender, as if men don't also have one. We need more women in politics, and this sort of thing unfortunately discourages that, as many qualified women are not particularly interested in entering a debate about whether or not their gender somehow makes them less qualified for the job or gives them an unfair advantage, which is another way of implying that they're less qualified for the job. I'd like to welcome Sarah Merck to the program. Sarah is the online editor for Bitch Magazine. Bitch, Feministing, and Making Contact have been working on a joint reporting project on reproductive rights in pop culture, thanks to support from the Media Consortium. Sarah is here to talk about an article she contributed called The Dramatic History of American Sex Ed Films. Welcome to RealityCast, Sarah.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So before we dig into the sex education details, let's talk about what this collaboration you're doing with Bitch Making Contact and Feministing is all about.
Well, it's really exciting. I mean, these are three outlets that all work on social justice-focused feminist media, but it's really rare to see media outlets work together like this. And we got a grant from a group called the Media Consortium, which is it's a group of independent media and magazines around the country to do a project focused on reproductive rights. And the topic we decided to focus on was reproductive rights in pop culture. In each of those outlets, myself at Bitch, Maya Dusenberry at Feministing, and Jasmine Lopez at Making Contact, chose a different aspect of pop culture that we would focus on and talk about the narratives about reproductive rights that we hear in each of those mediums. So I decided to focus on sex ed films because there hadn't been much written about that. Maya Dusenberry looked at sort of storylines around abortion in film, and Jasmine Lopez at Making Contact looked at two different pop songs, one by Nicki Minaj and one by Nick Cannon, that both deal with abortion. And then we co-published these stories, meaning they're all published on all of our three different sites, and we help promote them together. So hopefully these stories will get a wider reach and a wider audience because all three outlets are promoting them.
And so what's the impetus behind doing the sex ed particularly? There's a film documentary that's involved in this as well, right?
Yeah, there's a really great documentary called Sex Ed, the Movie, that's coming out in the fall that's directed by a woman named Brenda Goodman, a USC professor. I hadn't heard of that movie before I started this project. I was just interested in it. You know, I thought a lot about how sex ed films, which I'd seen some weird clips of online. Every once in a while, there's like a blog post about like, hey, look at this wacky sex ed movie from the 1960s. Like, did you know that Donald Duck was in a family planning movie? And whenever I see those, I've always wanted to know more. And I'm like, how did Donald Duck wind up in a family planning movie? Or what is this weird like anti-gay sex ed film that was shown in the 60s? What's the backstory on this? But although sex ed films are really tied to our sex ed curriculum, and I would argue there's, you know, it's the subject in school that's most tied to film of any subject I took, that you watch a lot of these in school. But there hasn't been a lot of critical analysis of the content of these films from a feminist or from a pop culture standpoint. Instead, the people who are discussing these films and sort of advocating for what the content should be are usually right-wing political groups and right-to-life groups. They're the ones who are organized on this issue, and they're the ones who are watching these movies. And so I thought it would be really interesting to go through from a feminist perspective and watch a lot of these films and talk to a lot of film historians about how the content is made for them and what the impact has been and how the stories in them and the messages of them have changed over time.
For the next segment, I started digging into some of the clips that you linked or sent me, and one thing that struck me and that you mentioned specifically in your article is how male-oriented a lot of these films are. Can you talk some about the gendered nature of sex ed traditionally and whether or not it's changed or gotten better in any way?
Sure. So the original sex ed films that were made in the United States, a lot of them were made to be shown to big groups in cities in the 1920s. The first one was made in 1914, and it was called Damaged Goods, and it's about a man who gets syphilis and ruins his life, essentially. And but since then, there have been a bunch that were made by the military to be shown to recruits. And a lot of these early films especially are really focused on men. And the sort of the premise that they're coming from is who's likely to get and spread venereal disease. It's men, that we should stop men from sleeping around. We should stop men from sleeping with women who have venereal disease. And really, these early films really frame prevention of venereal disease in terms of masculinity, in terms of saying, if you get these diseases and you give them to a virtuous woman like your wife, that will threaten your manhood, that will threaten your masculinity, that good men don't get VD. And part of this, I think, is because of who was making them and who was screening them. Since a lot of these were made for the Army, they're being shown to male recruits. And part of it is just that there wasn't an acknowledgement of the time that women like to have sex and that women have a sex drive just like men. And so, you know, I was really surprised to find, I talked to a sex ed film researcher named Robert Eberwein, who's a professor in Michigan, and he said he watched hundreds of these films from 1914 through the 90s. And he said he didn't see a film that mentioned that the clitoris was related to pleasure until the 1980s. And so while they're still framed around, you know, the sort of focus on men want to have sex and will be promiscuous and they will hurt women by doing this, we weren't really seeing an acknowledgement of female sexuality and pleasure up until the 80s, which seems like a very long time to be making these without having that acknowledgement. And even in a lot of the films that were made before then that sort of, you know, spell out the male reproductive anatomy and the female reproductive anatomy, I'm sure everyone remembers that segment in class of having sort of like the awkward drawings of genitalia on the board. A lot of the films will have that and not even have the clitoris be part of female anatomy.
And is it, so it like was a complete, not in the drawing or just not, or it's there and just not mentioned?
It's just not mentioned. And so they point out the ovaries and the fallopian tubes and the vagina, but there's no clitoris. And it was just, in these films you can look, and I see that as a real erasure of sort of female sexuality and the reason, you know, a major part of our genitalia.
And there were other negative stereotypes that you kind of talked about in the article, particularly about women who are sexually active or gay men generally. Can you kind of talk about how women who aren't, you know, quote-unquote virtuous women and gay men were portrayed in these movies?
Yeah, sure. So from the beginning up until now, still a lot of the sort of the messages of sex ed movies are that you should act in accordance with your gender. You should, good men act this way, good women act this way. Here's the proper moral way to act. In the 1950s and the 1940s, it's a lot about decorum, about here's how good girls act, here's how bad girls act. And a lot of the sort of messages toward women around hormone changes, while for men the discussion of hormone changes often mentioned there's, you know, sort of sexual impulses, how they might be having nocturnal emissions. The discussion around that for women was pretty much focused on sort of how you're growing up to be able to bear children. You might get childbearing hips and menstruation. The discussion around female hormone changes is focused on that. And when a lot of times in these films, when it does show women who want to have sex or who are sexually aggressive, they're sort of cast as a villain or as a bad character. One really interesting film that I talk about in the article is called Dance, Little Children, and it's from 1961. And it's just, I mean, it's laugh out loud ridiculous, where there's an outbreak of syphilis in a small town, and some sort of agent goes on the hunt for the source of the syphilis outbreak, and he goes to the ballpark, and there he sees a sexually aggressive blonde who's like staring down men and is picking at men at the ballpark. And by our standards today, it's really funny. I watched it because it's, you know, she's wearing, it's like a woman with like a cute bob haircut and like a cardigan with like pearly buttons, and like the fact that she's like suddenly painted as the villain, it just looks so ridiculous by today's standards. But when you look at sex ed films that are being shown today, a lot of the abstinent only material is essentially the same kind of message, that, you know, both men and women have sexual urges, and that what the right thing to do and the moral thing to do is to wait until you're with one partner far off in the future, and that if you do sleep around, it's gonna be trouble.
You know, despite that, though, like a lot of the clips that I looked through that you sent me have fairly progressive attitudes towards contraception itself. Like the military ones seem to believe that men were going to have sex no matter what and were more condom-oriented. And then, of course, there's the Donald Duck family planning one. So that seems a little out of step with that, I think, at least by modern standards. Can you talk about that?
That was a really big surprise in looking back at these movies, and that the researchers I talked to as well, this is a really major change in sex ed videos and films, is that when they're originally being made back in the, you know, the ones that were being made by the military, especially in the 1940s, were really pro-contraception. And they showed how to put on a condom, and the condoms were essential for preventing venereal disease, and really had a pro-condom message. And it seems like the sort of the idea behind the film was, well, men are going to have sex, and so you should definitely use a condom. It's a good idea. And then talking to a couple of researchers about how these films have changed over time, what they've pointed to is that in addition to disease still remaining the enemy of these movies, contraception has become an enemy in these movies. When you watch current films that are being shown in sex ed classes, there's a real emphasis on how condoms fail, how condoms are not 100% effective, how even if you use a condom, you could still potentially get pregnant, and that the only 100% surefire way to prevent pregnancy and disease is abstinence. And that's a really interesting evolution, where it's gone from being, you know, disease is an enemy, condoms are a good idea, to you really can't trust condoms. And those are the kind of films that are being shown today. One big piece of the article that I researched was looking at sex ed films that were recently made in Oregon, where I live. And Oregon has one of the nation's most progressive sex ed laws. We have a comprehensive sex ed policy statewide on the books. So if you're going to teach sex ed, it has to be medically accurate and comprehensive, which is pretty exciting. But it's still abstinence-focused. It's still an abstinence-first curriculum. And the films that were recently made for sixth grade classes statewide really show that. There's the film that was made, is about 33-minute long film that's shown in sixth grade classes all around the state. And condoms are mentioned once in this film. They're mentioned in the very last 4 or 5 minutes, and with the caveat of condoms fail. And so for this whole film, the whole message is the best option is saying no to sex. Here's a whole bunch of strategies and ways to stand up for yourself and ways to say no. And then the last minute, if you use a condom, watch out, it might fail. And that's in the most, you know, we have one of the most progressive sex ed laws in the country. And I think that's a lot because the state's under a lot of pressure from right to life groups and from abstinence only groups to say, to have a really conservative curriculum. And to say, and really the mainstream message in these sex ed films has become, you can't trust contraception.
And that's super weird, because when you do watch some of these older films, as you'll see in the clips that I play later, like they do say that you can trust contraception.
Yeah, it's really the message on contraception has changed to become more negative in our current films. When you look at films from the late 70s and 80s, they're very pro condom, and it's only been in the 1990s and 2000s. When really the abstinence movement has come in and gotten a lot of federal funding to make programs for classes, for sex ed classes. In the 1990s through the 2000s, they got, I think, over $1 billion to do abstinence-only sex ed programs. And some of that money went to making films and setting the curriculum for states, and that leads, I think, to a real focus on contraception being not a good option. But when you watch films from the 1940s and from the 1980s, there's lots of discussion of contraception in a positive light. One of my favorite films from the 80s is one in 1981 that's called Condom Sense, and it's like the most ridiculous 80s film. It's hard to describe, but there's a woman who's a magician, and she has like huge frizzy hair, and she's wearing like this magician outfit, and she like makes this huge condom appear on stage and like falls over a guy who I think is a wizard, and they like do this dance and there's this like groovy music playing. So that was a very pro-condom message in 1981, and it feels out of date now because it's a condom magician, but the sense is that condoms are normal. And another great film that I watched in 1986, which was made directly in response to the AIDS epidemic, is called Sex, Drugs, and AIDS. And it was shown in New York public schools. It was made for the New York public school district. And it's like this really interesting and really, by today's standards, very progressive video that involves groups of teenagers talking about their sex lives with their friends. And it's kind of stilted dialogue of like, hey, so I have a crush on this boy. What do you think I should do? And that kind of thing. But it's very straightforward about contraception and about and birth control. And one scene that I really like is a group of teen girls talking in a hallway, and they're talking about how they kind of want to have sex with these boys that they're dating. And one girl asks, you know, so have you talked to them about condoms and birth control? And the other girls are kind of awkward, and they're like, no, that's too awkward. I would never talk to them about that. And she says, if you can't talk to somebody that you're going to sleep with about birth control and contraception, you shouldn't sleep with them. And that's a really progressive method by today's standards. Like, oh, yeah, you should be able to talk to your partner about birth control and about contraception. And if you can't do that, maybe it's not time to have sex. Whereas today's message is more like, it's okay not to have sex. Don't have sex. If you do have sex, even your contraceptive measures might fail.
My guest today has been Sarah Merck. You can read her piece, which is amazing. It's called The Dramatic History of American Sex Ed Films at Feministine and at Bitch Magazine and at Making Contact. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Sarah.
Oh, it's so great to be here. You guys do such great work.
I got love for you if you were falling.
After that wonderful interview with Sarah, I thought it would be fun to play some of the clips from some of the sex ed films that she covers in her piece, which are all covered in the upcoming documentary Sex Ed, the Movie. There were a lot of movies that were clearly intent on preventing people from getting STIs, but sometimes those intentions backfired because the dramatic music and dialogue often ended up sending the opposite message, which is that getting an STI is shameful. Here's a clip from the 1961 sex ed film Dance Little Children.
Did you see this VD story? I don't know what's gotten into Kyle Foster. He's run a fine family newspaper for years, and now, what's he want to print something like this for, about people like that? Besides, Kyle knows as well as I do that this VD thing is licked. Syphilis can be cured in no time, and yet he publishes this scare stuff like an incurable plague was on us. Like every kid in town was involved. Well, my son isn't.
What researchers have learned since then is that shaming people about STIs or otherwise blowing them all out of proportion in this way is one of the surest ways to get people to ignore their own symptoms or live in denial. The movie also had a backfiring message in implying that the only way men could get STIs is to sleep with sexually forward women, who are coded as bad girls. So while trying to convey the message that STIs were everyone's problem, they ended up sending the message that it's only a concern for bad girls and the men who have sex with them. In reality, of course, STIs tend to be a problem that affects everyone, and they don't check to see if you fit some kind of arbitrary sexual moral standard before infecting you. That said, as Sarah points out, not all sex education was dour or frightening. Disney, for instance, had a couple of movies that are fairly upbeat for their time and tried to actually reduce fear and stigma. For instance, there's the 1948 animated short called The Story of Menstruation. In part, because it was a partnership with Kotex, it was in their best interest to assure girls that a period is not a particularly scary or debilitating thing.
And as for the old taboo against exercise, that's nonsense. Exercise is good for you during menstruation. Just use common sense. When you come to think of it, most of your daily routine is on the mild side. It's going to extremes that's wrong and to be avoided. To most girls, the menstrual period should bring no severe discomfort. Some girls have a little less pep, a feeling of pressure in the lower part of the body, perhaps an occasional twinge or a touch of nerves. But don't let it get you down. After all, no matter how you feel, you have to live with people.
Granted, they frame it with this assumption that women and girls are obligated to be especially sweet and accommodating, particularly to men. But by 1948 standards, it's not entirely retrograde, particularly in terms of throwing off so many of the stifling rules and taboos about menstruation that were so frequently used to police women and make them feel like their bodies were this unconquerable burden. Sex ed films were often aimed mostly or strictly at a male audience, which is why they were often blunt and accepting of human sexuality in ways that may surprise you, such as this film from the 1960s.
Every so often I get a strong sex urge, and the only way I can take care of it is to masturbate. And when I do, I feel awful. It's just like I've committed a crime or something. And it worries me, and I say, well, I won't do it anymore. And when I do, it goes away for a while, and I come back and do it again. And when I do control myself for a while, I end up with a wet dream.
George, I'm really pleased that you can tell me about this. Perhaps it's because we've known each other for so long. You know, you really don't need to be upset about this. Actually, the main thing that concerns me is that it has you upset. You know, this attitude goes back to when you were little. You probably don't even remember when you got these ideas, but obviously they're quite firmly planted in your mind. The only thing I can tell you as a doctor is that what you're doing is just part of growing up. It's something you probably will do once in a while, whether you think it's a good idea or not. I hope I can reassure you so that you aren't concerned. From a medical point of view, George, I only wish society could look at it in its proper light.
As Bitch Media's YouTube video Babies and Bananas points out, 30 years later, Bill Clinton was pressured to fire Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders for making the exact same point, albeit both for men and women instead of just for men. Even today, another 20 years later, there's still a number of books and videos out that try to argue that masturbation is wrong and should be avoided as much as possible. Clearly, we've endured decades of this struggle between people who have common sense enough to know that masturbation is normal and healthy and people who like to pretend that it's some kind of horrible sin to be overcome. But hopefully, with each generation, more and more people are beginning to see that it really is truly no big deal. I have one more clip to drive home how not new it is to be Franken-sex ed films, at least those aimed at men, about the fact that sex is a thing people do and it's foolish to expect them to abstain indefinitely. This is from a 1942 sex ed film for the Defense Department.
You're the guy who said gonorrhea was no worse than a cold. Well, I'll bet you never had a cold that felt just like that, did you?
Oh, no.
But gee, Doc, I'm only human. It's a biological urge.
We didn't say it was criminal. We just said if you did, to protect yourself. You were taught to pull in your rear when bullets were flying over you, weren't you?
Sure, Doc, but...
Then why the hell expose your front?
I must have got it on a toilet seat, Doc.
Now, that's a hell of a place to take a girl. And you, did you use a rubber?
No, Doc. She said she was married.
See, they even had a sense of humor about it. It's worth remembering that this film strip is 72 years old. Medical experts have known for a long, long time that condoms are, in real-world terms, a lot more effective at preventing STI transmission than pointlessly lecturing people on the supposed evils of sex. So why are we still debating it? Why do we still have a problem of people demonizing contraception? And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. What is it about Fox News and statutory rape edition? Tucker Carlson has been on and on lately about how it shouldn't count as statutory rape if the older person is female and the younger person is male. And now you have Jesse Waters trotting out the same line on the same network.
If you're a 6-year-old kid and you have sex with your best friend's mom, you usually get high fives, okay?
Oh, my goodness.
Let me just finish. Let me just finish, okay? She's not that attractive, so you might not have, you know, that kind of reception. But this can be emotionally damaging to the child, okay, psychologically. He's not mentally ready for this, so I understand. She's not Deborah LaFave.
He wasn't as out of control as Carlson, but it's still the same idea. And that idea is, to be blunt, that young men are inherently smarter and more capable of handling adult relationships than young women. The only reason to believe this is if you believe men are inherently better than women, full stop. And that's why you're seeing this nonsense come out of the mouths of so many men on Fox News these days.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.
From the Tax Justice Network. Around 20 minutes each month of news, scandal and analysis you won't find anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The TaxCast is available to everyone on www.tackletaxhavens.com. It's also on the Tax Justice Network's website, www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. You can subscribe to our RSS feed, to the Tax Justice Network's YouTube channel, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, look for us on iTunes, or find us on a radio station near you. Here's a quick Tax Justice News Roundup for this month. The beautiful game is in Brazil. Many thousands of people forcibly evicted, police brutality, pacification in Brazil's favelas, or free areas, as Brazilians prefer to call them, and a tax-free extravaganza for FIFA and its World Cup sponsors. Millions have demonstrated across the country. Over 10,000 people occupied land next to one of the stadiums in protest at all the taxpayer money their government's throwing at subsidising huge multinational companies. Yet they haven't got the money for improving public services like healthcare and education. And protests haven't been kept out of the stadiums. Here's something you probably didn't hear on the media. Football fans booing their Brazilian president and the head of FIFA. Listen to the reaction from the fans as their presence is announced at one of the matches.
Please welcome FIFA president Josep Blatter and the president of football.
And this chant against the Brazilian president by football fans is too rude to translate. According to Christian Aid, Brazil's going to lose more than £300 million in tax revenue to World Cup sponsors like McDonald's and Budweiser. Like the Olympic events, countries wanting to host the World Cup must first agree to these massive tax exemptions. But now it looks like some governments are going off hosting these type of events. Recently, Germany, Switzerland, Sweden and Poland withdrew their bids to hold the 2022 Winter Olympics because of worries about the costs. Maybe they're worried about riots too. 72% of the Fortune 500, the US's biggest corporations, use tax havens. That's according to a new report, Offshore Shell Games. These companies maintain nearly 8,000 tax haven subsidiaries, usually with no employees and little to no real business activity. US multinationals in general avoid an estimated $90 billion in federal income taxes every year. Do low corporate tax regimes in Ireland, Luxembourg and the Netherlands amount to illegal state aid? The European Commission thinks the deals those countries have made to attract Apple, Starbucks and Fiat may break EU competition rules. And now they've begun official investigations. More on that later. Here's a question for the diamond company De Beers. Are they willing to open up their books for inspection by independent evaluators appointed by the Namibian people? An open letter from campaigners in the country has thrown down the transparency gauntlet after a report on the diamond industry in South Africa found lots of transfer pricing manipulation. Now Namibians want to know if De Beers is paying its way fairly in their country. And on this month's Roll of Dishonour. Transparency can be so burdensome for vulnerable and poverty-stricken global insurance giants. They're the latest powerful lobby group trying to exempt themselves from global transparency rules being developed by the OECD. The Global Federation of Insurance Associations think an exemption for all existing insurance policies would be a really good idea. And if the OECD agrees to that, it'll be a bonanza for the offshore insurance industry, who often use these insurance vehicles as classic tax evasion and avoidance devices. The Clintons are so civic-minded. They've long supported an estate tax to stop inherited wealth dominating the United States. But it seems they didn't actually mean that fairness to apply to them. Here's Richard Rubin on Bloomberg TV.
What you find is the Clintons using what's known as a residence trust. So they took their home in Chappaqua in Westchester County, New York, divided it into two parts, put each half into trust, and then set that trust aside. And what that does is lets any appreciation in the house's value happen outside their estate. It lets them maybe claim a discount on the value of the house when they put it into the trust, which means they won't ultimately have to pay as much in estate taxes. Every dollar they save, they push outside the estate, you save 40 cents on the tax, and that's a big deal.
You might think it's not that important who gets to be the next European Commission president, but when you discover the favourite is Jean-Claude Juncker, the former Prime Minister of the tax haven of Luxembourg, it puts a bit of a different spin on it. The British Prime Minister doesn't like him because he's not likely to grant any special concessions for the UK, which might please Cameron's anti-European voters. We don't like him at the Tax Justice Network because in the past this guy did all he could to block European anti-money laundering directives and tried to get discussions on finance reform to be held in secret. If he gets to be president, expect further EU transparency reform to take a back seat. And that's the Tax Justice Roundup for this month. Now we're going to talk to Nick Shackson, author of the book Treasure Islands, for his take on this month. Okay, Nick, let's talk about the European Commission first of all. They're investigating the corporate tax arrangements of Apple, Starbucks and Fiat in Ireland, the Netherlands and Luxembourg. And they're looking at whether these arrangements constitute illegal state aid because, of course, the EU single market has rules about distorting competition. They're looking at whether what's happening in those countries is incompatible with the EU single market. And just to remind people, according to Apple, Ireland gave them a special 2% tax rate about 30 years ago. I mean, Ireland has denied that. The EU tax commissioner has been saying some pretty strong things about tax competition between member states, or as we prefer to call it at the Tax Justice Network, tax wars. And he's said things like the EU can no longer afford freeloaders who reap huge benefits in the EU without contributing to the public purse. So what is happening here? What are the implications?
Well, I think its hands are tied up to a certain point. I mean, governments do have a lot of autonomy to set their own tax rates and so on. It's a fairly narrow investigation that it's allowed to do, and this is an investigation into so-called tax rulings, and these are kind of sweetheart deals. Luxembourg, for example, by reputation, you know, you can get yourself a nice tax ruling for your multinational company by taking their, you know, Luxembourg offices out for a very nice lunch and discussing it over a bottle of champagne. And the EU has said that, you know, if you're going to do this, if you can do sweetheart deals that are only available to certain kinds of companies but not available to others, then that's illegal state aid. So these investigations have just begun. The European Commission is going to have to prove that the prices of the transactions, the tax rates that are being chosen, are out of whack with what they should be in a supposedly free market. So they're looking for special tax rates that have no economic justification. Of course, this whole area is incredibly slippery, and it's very difficult to get certainty on these things. So the outcome of this is still uncertain, but, you know, everybody knows, everybody in the business knows, I think everybody in the street who's been protesting about these matters also knows that these are sweetheart deals, these are special arrangements being given to large multinationals. But, you know, on the question of law, it's going to be a bit of a battle, I think.
Okay, and what's your hunch? I mean, if they're able to prove that they've had favourable treatment, some of these companies, what does that mean? They pay the money back, they start changing the tax rates they're offering companies, or what?
Well, they're going to have to change what they're doing. You know, a lot of these deals last a long time, and so, you know, companies that were expecting to get deals that stretch out into the future are going to have to face new tax rates and so on. You know, it's still uncertain, but, you know, one of the things, you know, there are lots of ways to be a tax haven. One is to cut your headline tax rate down to very low levels or zero or whatever, but there's another way of doing it is to create loopholes that enable you, even if you have, you know, substantial headline tax rates, you allow corporations to dodge through all these loopholes. And another way is just lax enforcement, just turning a blind eye, having these tax rulings, letting large multinationals get away with stuff that they technically shouldn't be allowed to get away with under law. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about kind of general laxity. And so, you know, let's hope that there's a result that at least brings some justice to European and other taxpayers.
Okay, so we'll be watching out for that on the TaxCast. Moving on then, there's some new research now, isn't there, on whether developing countries are actually even interested in or set up for automatic information exchange. Currently there's a global standard being developed rather slowly and with quite a lot of interference from interested parties who are trying to get in exemptions. So are developing countries set up for this or not?
Well, this is about if a country wants to get information out of a tax haven. In the past, it's been very difficult for them to do so. And until recently, the OECD has been pushing this very, very limited form of information exchange where you have to make a specific request about, you know already that there's somebody evading taxes, and you have to go to the jurisdiction and say, we believe this person is evading taxes, here's the bank account number, and then the jurisdiction will grudgingly give it to you. The Tax Justice Network for years and years was saying that the system being pushed by the OECD was just only slightly better than useless, and what was needed was automatic information exchange where the relevant information of taxpayers, you know, if a wealthy person has, you know, stashed some wealth in another jurisdiction, that jurisdiction ought to share the information with that wealthy taxpayer's home country so that they can be taxed appropriately on it. And we've been pushing that this is something that should happen automatically. And the OECD finally agreed with us and said, yes, okay, we're going to have automatic information exchange. And they put together this large and complicated document, which we thought was pretty good technically. It, you know, got a few loopholes, but it's certainly a massive, massive improvement on the next to useless system it was pushing previously. But one of the big criticisms we have now is that there's this kind of bias built into the whole system, because developing countries are supposed to give reciprocity. In other words, if Tanzania is trying to get information out of Switzerland, they say, well, you Tanzania are also going to have to set up all the complicated information gathering processes so that all the Swiss people who've got their money stashed in Tanzanian banks are going to be able to get the information too, which is obviously ridiculous. You know, when we're talking about secrecy, money is flowing from poor countries to rich countries. It's flowing from Nigeria to Switzerland and not the other way around. And then we had the head of the OECD tax department, Pascal Saint-Amant, saying not so long ago that he thought developing countries weren't interested in automatic information exchange. They didn't want it. They didn't need it. They weren't set up for it. It was all too difficult and complicated for them. And they said, he said this is on the basis of the research they'd done. So we, the Tax Justice Network, decided to go and actually test this. We sent some surveys to a number of developing countries. And the results that came back were rather different from what the OECD had been saying. We found out that developing countries were interested in automatic information exchange. They did certainly say they had a problem of capacity. You know, it would be difficult for them to analyze the data and to set up the technical systems for the data. But this is really a question of, you know, this is a matter of capacity building. But they were interested in it. They didn't want to be left out of it. They didn't want to continue to be looted by the world's tax havens, you know, have their own leaders stashing their stuff in the world's tax havens. So it's a very interesting political battle that's set to be fought now. We'll see if the OECD sticks to its line of, you know, this is really just for rich countries protecting themselves, or whether, you know, over the long term we can, you know, despite the fact that developing country governments are often conflicted because of the personal involvement of many of these players in the state looting. Civil society in these countries, I think, and ordinary citizens need to know that transparency, you know, is a great thing for them. And, you know, it's a fascinating long-term political battle that we'll be looking at to see how it plays out.
Okay, let's talk about the World Cup now. Looking at the host, Brazil's one of the most unequal countries in the world. And we have this situation which we've seen before with the Olympics, where countries wanting to host these things must agree to a whole raft of tax exemptions and effectively turn the place into a temporary tax haven for the sponsors and for the organisers of these things. According to Christian Aid, they're estimating Brazil could lose £300 million in tax revenue to the sponsors like McDonald's and Budweiser. Going back to the 2012 Olympics in London, there was a very effective campaign fought, and as a result, although some of them claimed that they were going to do this anyway, McDonald's, GE, Coca-Cola and Visa actually waived their tax exemptions. Whether they actually did voluntarily pay their tax, I'm not sure, whether anyone has looked into that and checked, or whether there's enough transparency even in their accounting to be able to do that. But, so here we are again, temporary tax havens with these huge sporting events.
Yeah, I mean, we saw this with South Africa as well 4 years earlier, where they had this so-called tax bubble, where effectively South Africa was expected to exempt FIFA from and its sponsors from all taxes, and it's the same thing in Brazil. Brazilians are absolutely furious that there's, you know, huge costs of these stadiums, which many people, you know, in places like Manaus up in the northeast, where they just don't think they're going to ever fill those stadiums again. £300 million is, you know, getting on for $500 million. And this is just a straight gift from poor Brazilian taxpayers to fabulously wealthy Zurich-based organization FIFA, you know, with its gilded headquarters up on a hill in one of the more shishy areas of Zurich.
And interestingly, some countries seem to be pulling out of bids to host future large sporting events because they seem to be quite worried about costs to the public purse and possibly about public reactions and demonstrations of the kind that we've seen in Brazil too.
Well, there do seem to have been a number of bids that have been withdrawn. There was an article in Slate recently pointing out that this may be the last World Cup in a democracy for a long time. I mean, maybe things do become so outrageous that you have to have authoritarian rule to have this stuff tolerated. The World Cup, everyone loves watching the matches, but what's going on behind the scenes is really quite repugnant. And I can't imagine FIFA's, you know, going to reform itself in any meaningful way.
Thanks, Nick. Nick Shackson from the Tax Justice Network and author of the book Treasure Islands. If you haven't read it yet, you really should. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. If you stood up for progressive taxation a few years back, you got accused of being some kind of hard-left communist lunatic, and you were definitely anti-capitalism. But now a new book's forcing even those right at the top of the tree to talk about inequality and redistribution. This month, the TaxCast looks at the work of economist Thomas Piketty and asks, what's all the fuss about?
Within societies, inequalities of outcomes both within and, very importantly, across generations have demonstrably increased. And returns in a globalized world are amplifying the rewards of the superstar, and though few would be willing to admit it, the lucky.
This is Comrade Mark Carney, head of the Bank of England, speaking recently at a conference called Inclusive Capitalism, and I'm not making this up.
For markets to sustain their legitimacy, they need not only to be effective, but also to be fair. There needs to be a sense of society. Unchecked market fundamentalism can devour the social capital that is essential for long-term dynamism of capitalism itself. All ideologies are prone to extremes. Capitalism's no different.
These are definitely not words Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan would ever have used. And listen to this. Here's head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, speaking to CNN.
You know, less than 100 individuals actually own pretty much the same as the poorest half of humanity. That's an issue, clearly. Rising inequality are not conducive to sustainable growth. That's point number one. Point number two is redistribution policies, if well designed and calibrated and not excessive, are not bad for growth, which was conventional wisdom for a long time.
So two surprising converts to the belief that capitalism needs to be fairer. But let's just get some perspective here. Christine Lagarde's salary plus perks is bigger than the US president's, and it's tax-free. And the head of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, earns over 30 times the average salary in the UK. So why have they got the inequality bug now? Maybe it's because they've realised capitalism needs saving from itself. Here's Thomas Piketty, the author of the book that's got them worried, Capital in the 21st Century.
You know, it's great to have entrepreneurs, it's great to have new wealth being formed, but this has to be compatible with the size of the world economy. You know, if the top of the distribution is rising 3 or 4 times faster than the world economy, if you have that during the next 50 years, basically all the wealth will belong to a very small international elite, and there will be no wealth middle class anymore, and there will be a level of inequality which is simply not compatible with our democratic and meritocratic values.
That's because he says the logical progression of unchecked capitalism is pretty extreme. His research shows most of the time the rate of return on capital is greater than the rate of economic growth of output and income. What that means is the share of the pie going to working people declines in relation to the share that goes to the owners of capital. Without redistribution, the gap between rich and poor people will inevitably widen. Rising inequality won't worry the 1% or actually the 0.1%, but it's bad news for everyone else.
And actually, it's bad news for capitalism. Economist John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network.
Piketty is not Karl Marx. This is not a rehash of Das Kapital. What he's doing is he's using very long-term data sets to demonstrate this maldistributive outcome of raw capitalism, the kind of capitalism we returned to in the 1980s. He thinks that capitalism can deliver the goods, but it needs to have strong government-led regulation and redistribution to achieve the kind of broader public good that capitalism, in his argument, is capable of. He, like Keynes, is identifying a way to kind of reboot capitalism for the 21st century, and I think that's his project.
Thomas Piketty's book's been published at an interesting time of disillusionment in Europe. In the recent European election results, significant numbers of the electorate who decided to come out and vote rejected traditional political parties in favour of parties like France's Front National.
I think all people looking to the result in France, this is a bad day for the European Union, when a party with such an open racist, xenophobic and anti-Semite program gets 25 or 24% of the voters in France, but this is not the only country. The reasons behind such a vote for a party like this party in France is not that people are hardcore extremists. Behind the vote is a lot of disappointment, complete loss of trust that we as Europeans care about these people and their faith and the future of their children.
That's a rather shaken European Commission presidency hopeful, Martin Schulz. It seems like it's more than time to try and address inequality. John Christensen.
The current situation is untenable. And I think it's helpful that it's a Frenchman who's coming forward with this analysis, because the French have a past experience. They have track record when it comes to situations where massive wealth inequalities leads to revolutionary situations and complete breakdowns.
Yes, and the guillotine can testify to that.
Yes, Madame Guillotine will be back on the streets. The civilized solution to this lies with progressive taxation.
This is a quote from him. Progressive income tax is indispensable for making sure everyone benefits from globalization, and the increasingly glaring absence of progressive taxation may ultimately undermine support for the globalized economy. And that is exactly, you could argue, what we're seeing now with the aftermath of the European elections, where this frustration of people who haven't benefited seems to be finding expression in anti-immigration sentiment rather than anti-inequality sentiment, you could say.
And far too many people see actually that their situation has deteriorated. Their jobs are more fragile. Their incomes have at best stood still, in many cases declined in real terms. Their pensions have gone. Their grandchildren and their children's prospects are diminished. And the potential for kickback against that and return to petty nationalism is enormous. It does mean that the momentum for a better globalization will not be achieved unless politicians recognize the benefits need to be more broadly spread. In his analysis, and certainly the data he produces, paints a very compelling picture that he's correct. We're going to see low rates of growth through the 21st century, accompanied by a huge concentration of wealth in the hands of a tiny minority. The sustained long-term periods of growth that we saw in the capitalist West in the 1950s, the 1960s and the 1970s. It's unlikely that's going to be repeated.
Right, and I suppose the most depressing part is that Piketty seems to see the social gains in many countries after the First and Second World War as historical aberrations, so not likely to happen again. Things like the creation of a welfare state and strong public services like the National Health Service, the rise of trade union power, investment in public education, the introduction of progressive taxation, a higher standard of living for the middle classes. And now those tendencies towards greater equality provoked by those kind of international emergencies have been reversed. Here's Thomas Piketty speaking to the magazine Foreign Affairs.
I think one of the historical lessons of the book is that 19th century inequality was not useful for growth. European countries, in particular, that had a very extreme concentration of wealth until World War I, had a much more equal distribution of property in the 50s, 60s, and this did not prevent growth from happening. Quite the opposite, in fact. So, you know, we should be worried about returning to the kind of extreme inequality that we had in the 19th century.
John Christensen.
We're back to business as usual for capitalism. That is, capitalism has no trend towards convergence and greater equality. Actually, the long-term trend is towards divergence and greater inequality. The 21st century is going to be more like the 19th century than the 20th century, in that we're going to see the return of a tiny proportion of the population, quite simply living off the rents, which they accrue from the activities of others.
And don't pay tax on.
And they don't pay tax on it, because, of course, the difference between the 21st century and the 19th century is, oh my gosh, we've now got all these tax havens, and all the ultra-high net wealth individuals have settled all of their wealth in offshore trusts and in offshore companies and don't pay any tax on it whatsoever.
Why is this a manifesto for tax justice? Why do you say that?
What he's laying out is the reason why it's now really important at the international and national levels for us to reconsider our tax regimes, which are overly focused on taxing labour and consumers and don't sufficiently tax wealth and high income earners. What he has done is he said there is a very strong, in fact compelling case. If you're going to have globalized capital movements, then you must have automatic information exchange, you must have more transparent markets, you must have stronger cooperation, particularly on tax between countries. And in that respect, I think this is clearly a tax justice manifesto. He says it's impossible for nation states and democracy to survive in an era of totally globalized capital markets where capital can quite simply evade and avoid taxes.
He's quite negative and perhaps realistic, you could say, about the potential for governments and for the finance industries around the world and all these offshore centres to actually conform to any kind of rules which are now being negotiated for greater transparency. So he's kind of seems to be throwing his hands up in the air a bit and saying, well, you know, sanctions, and he actually puts forward some interesting proposals on automatic sanctions for any country that's not conforming to the new rules.
Well, Piketty is absolutely right when he says that countries like Luxembourg and Switzerland and the British tax havens simply will not cooperate until they're brought kicking and screaming to the table. And that's precisely been our experience with the tax justice movement, that these countries will do everything in their power to resist trends towards international cooperation. I'm very glad that Piketty talks about sanctions. But I also am very glad that he mentions some things which are an absolute taboo for most politicians. He talks about, you know, there is no truth whatsoever to this idea that chief executives will work less hard if they're taxed at a higher progressive rate. And he also calls for much higher wealth taxes to tackle the plutocrats and the oligarchs of this world. He puts forward the idea of a 10% annual wealth tax for these extraordinary billionaire fortunes that have been built up. This might appear provocative, but frankly, we have reached the stage in the global economy where wealth is so badly distributed and it is actually harming prospects across the world. And I think that's being recognised increasingly by the IMF and others, that the current situation is untenable.
You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.